You're watching Deprogrammed. This is the new Culture Forum show devoted to fighting back against the forces of ideological conformity, particularly among the young. My name's Harrison Pitt. I'm a senior editor at the European Conservative, and I'm thrilled to be joined today, as ever, by Evan Riggs, who is a freelance journalist, and our special guest this week, Leo Kearse, who you will recognise, no doubt, as the comedian at GB News. Now, Leo, at the moment, it seems that free speech is in very serious peril in this country. There are a whole range of ways in which this is true, no doubt we'll get into them. But you're quite a cheery fellow. Are you remotely optimistic about anything that's going to be coming on the horizon on the free speech front? Or do you think that it's only really going to get worse over the next 10 years or so?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's going to get worse, but things have to get worse before they get better. I feel like every few generations, like, people have to make the same catastrophic mistakes again and have some sort of, you know, communist revolution, whether that, you know, creeps in like it is across the West. I mean, if you look at the share of GDP spent by governments, it's ratcheting up in every Western country. Argentina has sort of shown how eventually that reaches a point where Gaul has to get stripped back and afuera.
Yeah.
But I mean, it's happening economically, but it's also happening culturally and socially. And indeed, I think, you know, there's so many factors behind this. I think a big one could be the drop in testosterone across the West, because that makes, you know, it's like Plato had this idea of thymus, and that's the sort of spirit, the self, the drive and your self identity and agency. And I think, you know, without testosterone, that goes. You know, people with low testosterone, especially men, like high testosterone men will feel able to take positions and hold opinions that are against what the sort of mob believe. And if you've got low testosterone, then you just want to be a sort of sheep going along with the herd.
That's what I keep telling myself, at least.
Yes. Yeah.
Do you think, though, it's a great time for comedy, specifically for you, because you have this opportunity now to kind of say what everybody else will not, maybe because you're high T?
But yeah, I mean, we've got an opportunity to say it, but where can we say it? Where can it be broadcast? I mean, the establishment has made pretty clear that they're sort of coming for GB News, particularly as it's now sort of defied their expectations, and it's incredibly successful. Maybe not, you know, financially at the moment, but certainly in terms of viewership, it's overtaken Sky News, and it's sniffing at the BBC's heels. But I mean, so I think there's a lot of pressure from the left. It'll be interesting when Labour get in if they try and shut down GB News and, you know, platforms like that give alternative comedians somewhere where they can actually critique and pick apart society at the moment. Because at the moment, you know, if you criticise, say, gender ideology, you're literally like committing a hate crime. In Scotland, they brought through the Hate Crime Act, which, you know, literally, if you criticise gender ideology, if you say, oh, maybe, you know, we shouldn't be, sterilising and maiming children, then you're committing a hate crime. My tour, I was supposed to be going on tour like last autumn, and it got cancelled because the promoter couldn't slot my show into theatres. Too many of the theatres said, like, we can't platform this guy because he's, you know, he's racist, he's transphobic, he's homophobic, he's misogynist. And yeah, I am, but those things are all funny and good things to do on stage. So yeah, I mean, I think culturally, socially, there's a lot of pressure on conformity and not questioning things. And also, you know, that's you know, politics and legislation is always downwind of culture, but now it's coming through in the legislation and it's coming through in the politics. I bet when Labour get in, they make a concerted effort to silence all their critics, and the SNP are already doing it. So yeah, it'll be interesting to see. But then they'll go after someone. There'll be, you know, a moment where they go after somebody like J.K. Rowling, and it'll be the wrong person to go after. J.K. Rowling's got the resources to defend herself. People like her in the real world, away from the, you know, the tiny Twitterati who we scream at each other. In the real world, a lot of people are completely unaware of the culture wars and how this could affect them, even though it's got huge actual real life ramifications in terms of, I mean, we spoke about the sort of sterilization of children. There's also, you know, males getting access to women's safe spaces. There's all kinds of things. There's the long-term demographics of our country. Everything is to play for in the culture wars.
Yeah, no, it's very true, and it's worse even than that in Scotland, though, isn't it? Because I think there was, I mean, I think there's going to be a, there's a recently going to be a, there's going to be a ratcheting up of the hate speech laws that are already in place. But already in March of 2021, a new hate speech law, as I understand it, I mean, you're obviously a Scotsman yourself, was passed in Scotland.
Yeah, it's only just coming into
oh, it's only
power.
Just it's,
yeah,
it's yeah. only just coming into effect.
So April the 1st.
I see, yeah, but it's good. But I've read some of
great
the legislation.
Great day
for it. I read some of the legislation as well, and it suggests that it, if you fall afoul of those certain speech violations, you could be punishable for it with a prison sentence of up to 7 years, and that there's no what is technically called, there's no sort of dwelling exception. So,
the privacy
in the privacy
home.
Of your own home, you can be picked upon. So it's not just at comic venues, it's not just on Twitter and on all these other places. I mean, that's objectionable enough, but it's now reaching into every detail of people's lives, completely collapsing the private public distinction. And only recently in Belgium, because this is a European phenomenon, this is a Western phenomenon.
Yeah.
Only recently in Belgium, we saw a nationalist Belgian politician prosecuted successfully and convicted for circulating, you know, edgy memes in a group chat. I mean, who hasn't done that? You know,
well, that's the thing. So, everybody's guilty
of
these. You know, this is like these are universal sins.
Yeah. Yes.
So the danger of the Hate Crime Act is it's just going to be used by the SNP to go after and silence their critics. You know, as they've already done. So Marion Miller, for example, is a gender critical feminist. She was prosecuted or arrested. You know, was thrown out of court. Mm. Thankfully. But her crimes included things like tweeting a picture of a suffragette ribbon, and somebody perceived that to be a noose, so said it was a transphobic, you know, a transphobic hate crime because it's saying they should hang themselves or whatever. Which is, I mean, it sounds ludicrous, but this is how the legislation is worded.
Indeed.
You don't even need a victim. Somebody can be, you can be offended, or you can be, you know, you can perceive a hate crime to have occurred on somebody else's behalf, or it could just be a you know, something that doesn't affect any specific individual. So then you can make, you know, some sort of vexatious claim against that person. And if it's somebody who's criticized the SNP's ideology, mm-hmm. so Marion Miller, you know, she criticized the gender ideology, they can go after you. And I mean, that case, the Marion Miller case, was thrown out of court. But in cases like this, the process is the punishment.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they sent goons to arrest her. She's got kids. They're all terrified. You know, she's terrified. A journalist who was at the, I think at the court or at the police station said, you know, it was literally like something out of, you know, Judge Dredd, mm-hmm. some, you know, Orwellian dystopian nightmare. They had like big, heavy, like she was some sort of, you know, flight risk to Al Qaeda or something.
Yeah.
You know, either side of her to intimidate her in this sort of, you know, Darth Vader type way.
Far more sinister than what happened to people like Marion Miller. Like, even though that's all true, what you're saying is the chilling effect that it has on everyone else, because there doesn't need to be a successful prosecution for that effect to take place.
Well, and what you need is a claim and not any sort of like actual like tangible victim or crime. What's to stop people from just accusing every single member of the SNP of being hateful bigots?
But that'll be, I mean, number one, that'd be valid, because most of them are hateful bigots. They're certainly
you said that, not me.
No, I mean, like, if you look at the SNP, I mean, people say the BNP, the British National Party, are bigoted or whatever. The SNP are just the Scottish version of it. They're built on nationalism and not a particularly, you know, friendly, cuddly nationalism.
I agree with that, but the other peculiar thing about that, Leo, is that virulent Scottish nationalism made sense when they hated the English. Humza Yousaf seems to hate the Scots. which it seems to me to be a very demented form of nationalism. I mean, what kind of nationalism is that? If it's not sort of directed outwards, it's sort of directed inwards. Well, he's Palestinian. I think that is genuinely the answer. But it's very peculiar. Like, one of the things that I wanted to ask you about is and this is as true in Ireland as it is in Scotland.
Yeah.
Is that, like, it seems to me that Celtic nationalism is one of the most morally confused forces in the world at the moment, and it is much more interested in sort of nagging and indeed through replacement migration just completely supplanting its own native populations than it is in actually serving them and trying to, you know, glory in Irish identity or Scottish identity. So it's not even really ethno-nationalist.
Well, it's been hijacked. So I mean, the SNP, they do march, they march side by side with literal ethno-nationalist fascist groups like Seán An Gaeil. So you know, that'd be, I mean, I don't even know if I don't even know if that level of sort of ethno-nationalist group exists in England. You know what I mean? It gets stamped down by the authorities straight away. So they do sort of ally themselves to some pretty unsavory groups when it suits their purpose. But they've hijacked the whole nationalist movement. And it sort of gave them... One of the issues with devolution is it just creates this sort of satellite state with very little oversight and accountability compared to Westminster, which is all the, you know, the eyes of the country focused on it. And it's a, Scotland's a small country, so there's much more opportunity for sort of nepotism and corruption. And because it's sort of it's got this message of, you know, independence, that sort of almost gives it... it's almost like a dictatorship because they always get in because they've always got that sort of resonant message that, you know, appeals to the hearts of a certain proportion of Scottish people who, you know, maybe aren't aware. You know, most people don't spend all day reading about, you know, what the SNP are doing. Most people won't be aware that there's a hate crime act coming through. And most people won't wake up to it until there is some sort of big event, like they go after J.K. Rowling or, you know, somebody... you know, somebody like Marion Miller dies in a gulag. You know, there won't be an awakening until something big happens.
Do you think people are likely to continue voting for the SNP no matter what they do, so long as they keep kind of promising eventual Scottish independence?
Yeah, I think with the Tories in power, it's an easier sell in Scotland. There is a sort of a lot of anti-Tory sentiment. In Scotland, they're seen, and I don't know where they get this from, it's seen as the party of sort of the posh English elite. I mean, looking at them, man, Boris Johnson came from the council estates. But yeah, I mean, so they've got a point there. I think with Labour in power and, you know, having another authoritarian, communist, socialist crap tank running, you know, the country, is going to be, you know, a harder sell to say, well, we're a different kind of communist scum. Yeah, you know what I mean? So that'll be interesting to see how it affects them. And also, I mean, I think, you know, as much as Nicola Sturgeon you know, as much as she's got her faults, she was kind of likable to a lot of Scottish people. They, you know, she resonated with them. She's pretty, you know, she's pretty good at speaking.
Fierce, capable.
Pretty position. Good at, you know, crowbarring money out of Westminster to distribute to you know, buy votes in a sort of, peronism. I think Hamza doesn't have any of
that. No, he doesn't have that.
What happened to Sturgeon? Didn't she get arrested? You haven't heard anything from her in ages.
I know her husband was, like, carted away in the morning, like a, you know, like a Colombian drug dealer.
The accusations of corruption within the party and nepotism, that sort of thing. And it just sort of disgraced on those grounds.
Unbelievable.
And of course, she did not do as, like, despite I just said she's a very fierce and capable politician. I did believe that, but she didn't demonstrate any of that kind of competence over the whole trans issue that occurred. Has gone. Remember, there was the case of
Isla Fisher.
Is that right?
Yeah, or Adam Fisher.
The chap.
A genuine, real woman. Yeah. She's trans woman, a real woman.
Yes.
Just like me.
Go through the catechism.
I'm a real woman. Look at my pronouns on Twitter if you don't believe me. So you're this guy. Was all like, I think he was done for, like, rape and stuff.
Yeah.
And he was like, oh man, I've been done for rape, but I'm going to keep doing it. What can I do? And then so he identifies as a woman. Yeah. So the SNP, oh, right, yeah, you're a real woman, it says in this, you know, communist textbook. Mm. So they send him to women's prison.
That's right.
Absolute, like, obvious, like, where's the common sense?
Yeah, no.
Where's the, you know, any sort of, you know, obviously any system that gets set up, you know, I'm not denying that there's, you know, genuine trans people who live and, you know, benefit from identifying as whatever gender or whatever and put the effort in and appear like Blair White. You know what I mean? You wouldn't send Blair White. It'd be weird to make Blair White stand at a urinal. But I mean, any system, people are going to game it. You know what I mean?
Of course they are. Not only did she fall for that, she then defended it, that decision, in, like, the most pitiful terms. I don't think that helped her reputation as well. Yeah. I think it also came out that a lot of SNP voters, who you would imagine are just pretty ordinary patriotic Scottish people who have the kind of common sense that you're describing, didn't particularly appreciate that. And so this is another weird thing with Celtic nationalism, such as it has morphed over the last, I don't know, 2 decades or so. There seems to me to be a real mismatch between the elites who spearhead Celtic nationalism, whether in Ireland or Scotland, and the people, the sort of the rank and file who support it, who are just, you know, flag-loving actually quite, in social and cultural terms, at least quite conservative, at least with respect to Ireland or with respect to Scotland. Not conservative about England, but they're conservative about those places. They love them and they want to keep them how they are.
Scotland is historically, you know, quite a conservative place. You know, it's the birthplace of the Enlightenment. It's quite a sort of, you know, Protestant, parsimonious, Calvinist kind of place.
Absolutely.
So yeah, you can see, and I think Ireland's got the same problem as Scotland. It's a small country. It can sort of, there isn't as much ballast holding the government in the center, so it can spin wildly to the fringes, and you can see that with the Irish government. Irish government spends 8% of the country's budget, 8%, huge amount of money, relatively huge amount of money, on NGOs that then, so these are special interest groups that then advise the government and feed the government what it wants to hear. And then the government can say, oh, well, we've listened to the people.
Yeah.
Look, this is these special interest groups that represent the people are coming to us and saying, you know, we need to do this. Oh, we need vastly more immigration. Mm-hmm. You know, we need gender, we need to change gender laws and all this sort of stuff. And this is the same kind of thing is happening in Scotland. Ireland recently had a wake-up call when they had the referendum to change the definition of the family and to change, you know, reword the constitution to change how women are represented in there. And initially, when it was presented by the government, it looked like it was going to go through. It looked like it was going to be a slam dunk. But then people woke up to it, and just through sort of talking to each other and discussing it in private, a lot of political discussion has moved to private spheres on social media, encrypted channels, WhatsApp, Telegram, all the rest of it. It went way the other way, and the referendum was a cataclysmic disaster for the government. So the people, when the people are presented with something, and when the people are sort of forced to assess it and wake up to it, it can all crumble down. And I think in Ireland, they've already seen that with the Catholicism. Catholicism sort of ruled over Ireland for so long. You know, my wife's Irish, and speaking to her mother and hearing the horrible times a lot of people had under Catholicism. Like my mother-in-law had, you know, she was forced to stay with a guy, you know, abusive guy, and had the priest come down and like forcibly, you know, come into the home and basically, you know, whatever, baptize or whatever they do to the kid. And now, of course, under these governments, you're forced to transition the kid. But that...
A different kind of theology.
Yeah. Slightly less well thought out one. But that's our carapace. That veneer, you know, Ireland was considered a Catholic country, and then word of mouth broke it down, and then suddenly that shell just collapsed in.
The other thing is, though, with that is that whereas the secularization process which took effect in Ireland, the church felt very demoralized by all of that, and so ever since the church has been trying to appease, like show off how in Ireland and well in generally this is quite a popular thing among all forms of clergy, but trying to show off how hip and how modern and how liberal they really are.
Oh yeah,
they're
trying to
after the fact. Whereas with this new clerisy that we have, there's none of that sort of humility. I mean, but Leo Varadkar, in the immediate aftermath of I think it was an Algerian immigrant who went around stabbing schoolchildren in Dublin, and
well, they said he's not an immigrant because he's a naturalized citizen.
Citizen.
Oh man, like come on, filled in a form.
I know.
He's not born in Algeria anymore.
He holds a piece of paper which just changes the calculus. Apparently, yeah. But anyway, so but rather than going, oh my gosh, you know that there's a clear, like righteously indignant public outcry against this, and rather than feeling demoralized by, oh gosh, maybe we should go back on some of our catechism, the new clerisy, the new elite in place in Ireland, decided to try and crack down on that public sentiment, and which is why we're talking about hate speech bills. There's now one going through in Ireland, and you mentioned people wanting to communicate through Telegram, wanting to communicate through WhatsApp, through these private means. That is going to be very much in the legislation. I mean, in Ireland, you can be prosecuted for things you say in a private group chat. You can be prosecuted for items that you hold in your home, which might potentially suggest a kind of problematic ideological stance.
Yeah. And they'll be shutting down those secure and encrypted channels. I mean, you see in America, they're already, I mean, it's slightly different. TikTok is kind of the opposite of encrypted, but they're shutting down TikTok. And it's not, you know, they say, oh, it's because China can get access to this data. It's like, man, China can just go and buy that data. Yeah. It's like that data is not very secure. You can legitimately purchase that data on the open market. But the real issue is that certain ideas are spreading, and are probably encouraged by the Chinese owners of TikTok, that are damaging to the USA and damaging to Israel as well.
Well, I was just going to say, you know, it's consistently funny to me that basically the IRA and the Irish people went through like these incredible times of trouble just to become a tax haven for like gay race contests. So, but anytime I think about Ireland, I think about that. But then I think about how tragic it'll be that I think because the Irish had such a rough time at the Catholic Church, there's no real way out of this for them. Like they'll be forced to basically say like, well, if we give up this, we're just going back to it's like our bad ex or something like that. Like, they don't have a good and easy
story.
Out.
A good story to fall back on, you mean.
And so my question would be,
can't we just go back to like what 1997, whatever that was? That seemed to be all right.
Well, the election of Blair, you mean?
No, just like in the culture. Actually,
that was a bad day.
Actually, Blair's election at the time, it seemed great, and there was a lot of, you know, there's a lot of good things about you know that government. But there's also, man, people never think through the unintended consequences. You know, the unforeseen consequences of things like opening the borders completely.
Yeah, I mean, well, spoken like a true conservative, but the problem is that we can never go back. So my question to you would be, like, what does a way forward for Scotland look like that would be sane?
Yeah. I don't know, man. Like, most people just want to get on with their lives, live their lives, and not have the government. I think Scotland, the UK needs a constitution. I think in America you're protected by this constitution that preserves your freedom of speech, and you know, can be tinkered around with and all the rest of it. You know, platforms can be taken away. But it's like Howard Jacobson said it, I feel much more threatened by people who would try and silence you know, problematic jokes or whatever than I feel threatened by the jokes themselves, by the speech itself. So I think we need a sort of Javier Milei type figure to come in and slash, because it's not just a cultural thing, it's an economic thing. So much of the economy in Scotland, and I mean across the West, but particularly in Scotland, because we get so much largesse from Westminster, is controlled by the public sector, is controlled by the government. And that's, you know, that sort of creeping, that move to sort of soft communism is really corroding society, growing the economy, and it's hand in hand with this cultural thing of controlling what people can say, what topics are acceptable to discuss.
It certainly wouldn't hurt to entrench free speech rights in Britain in the same way that free speech rights in the United States are entrenched by the First Amendment. But like having a constitutional settlement which guarantees these things on paper doesn't necessarily always guarantee them in reality. Like in order for a constitution to work in any given territory, there needs to be sort of a strong reserves of public belief in it. There needs to be a strong sense of unity around it and all that sort of thing. That's clearly breaking down in the United States. And a really good example of how constitutionalism doesn't necessarily get you what constitutionalism promises is the fact that Liberia has had a constitution which is identical to the United States' constitution in many key respects since, I believe, it must be the 1860s. Yeah. So, and that hasn't, you know, that it hasn't become a beacon to the world in the same way that the United States has. And so I would be concerned about resting our laurels too much on constitutional changes and shifts and tinkering. But I do think it would be, like, given that people in this country do still believe in free speech, across the board generally. Right. So this is what I was about to say. If that's collapsing, which it clearly is a bit, it's not where it was maybe 50 years ago or so. And also at the same time, you've got a new generation of young people who are much more concerned with the hurt feelings of minorities.
You know, we need a war, not just to kill the young people, but also
steady on.
But the ones that don't get killed, to just make
to harden them,
to make them not pussies. We just, the pussification. I think Patrice O'Neill spoke about this in his stand-up.
Many times.
Rest his soul.
Yeah.
Like, the pussification of society is just, man. And it comes back to this sort of lowering testosterone thing.
Point.
Yeah. That's what you got to get down the gym. You got to do, like, I should follow my own advice, but, like, you got to, like, go and do squats and stuff that boosts your testosterone. You got to eat zinc tablets and take anabolic steroids injected directly into your buttocks. You've got to do all these things for society to succeed.
Yeah, well, Eric Kaufman has made this point, and so I think Noah Carr has made it in Aporia as well, that there is, in all likelihood, a connection between, like, obviously everyone is an individual, and you get masculine women and you get feminine men. Obviously, that's the case.
Sounds like Scotland.
It probably does. But you do get... at scale, you can still measure things, and Eric has made the point in print that one of the reasons why wokeism appeals to women a lot more than old-fashioned communism appealed to women. Like, it used to be very male.
Yeah.
It was precisely because old-fashioned sort of economic socialism used to couch itself in terms of scientific hard-headedness and justice, which tend to appeal to the male palate of moral foundation theory.
Owning the means of production, having a stake in it.
And look at Soviet art. It's all sort of glorifying the dignity of the worker.
It looks like reactionary at this point. Yeah.
Exactly, it looks incredibly reactionary. Whereas with wokeism, it's much more concerned with compassion and trying to protect supposedly vulnerable groups as though they're kind of pets.
Yeah.
And that appeals much more to women.
Yeah.
And Eric has documented this in some detail.
Well, the cruel irony is that old school communists of like the actual Marxist days would think that modern woke people are like subhumans.
Oh yeah. they would hate them. Yeah. Like, Marx was very, in many, as a person, was quite prim and proper. He's quite bourgeois, actually. He'd hate to be called that, it's going to change.
He's unemployed his entire life.
Yeah, that's true.
And social justice is really just a new religion. Andrew Doyle wrote a book about it, New Puritans, and how it is. It's basically indistinguishable from a religion, except the tenets of progressivism aren't carved into clay tablets where they don't change. And instead, they change on a sort of hourly basis. Mm. So you got to keep up, and you got to like keep reading The Guardian to find out what the acceptable word is for, should I say BAME? Should I say BIPOC? Should I say global majority? Everything changes all the time, so the sands are constantly shifting. But it's driven by women. No offense to any women listening. I mean, this is looking at this podcast, there probably won't be any. But the religions of the old days weren't like people are like, oh, it's patriarchal. It's like, no, those things were matriarchal. Those things were kept going by women. Mm. Women wanted the religions going. Women wanted to trap men in a sort of family unit. It was a great system. Men want to run around. The liberalization in the 60s suited men to the ground. You can run around shagging whatever you want, you know what I mean? Now you can, dress up in a frock and, prance around, and everybody claps and says you're brave. Like, this is all suiting men. And the religions of the old days were, it wasn't men saying, like, oh, come on, get up, dear, let's go down to the church and sit in a cold pew and give them money. Like, that was women making the men do it, because that structure sort of suited them. And also that whole, that thing's more common in women and pussified men, of that sort of the judgment and the sort of, having an outcast to spit on and say, they said the bad thing. They said BAME, and this week the word is BIPOC. Having somebody to point the finger
at. But Louise Perry has this interesting idea that a lot of this is a misdirected maternal drive as well, because only far fewer women today are having children, and so instead of having that surrogate object of a child that you care for, it becomes the Somali on the boat.
I mean, look at the migrant crisis in Germany, where you have like middle-aged German women who are giving like 20-year-old Syrians like a teddy bear as they get off at the train. Like, they don't need that. You could at least give them food or something, but it's like literally. Changing the topic slightly, but something I actually really wanted to ask you about, which is the current drug crisis in Scotland, and
crisis. We got no problem getting drugs.
clearly. But, one of the places I like to bring up on this podcast time and time again is Singapore, which has obviously managed to cure its drug crisis through being, fairly authoritarian and having an overpowering government. My question is, like, how do you fix Scotland's drug crisis when you can't rely on the government to do anything but be authoritarian in a very inept and bizarre way?
Yeah, I mean, Singapore's interesting because it's actually kind of based on the UK, like the guy who set up the system of government and everything there. He came to London, he saw orderly and what a high trust society it was, and he said, I want to replicate this in Singapore. Whereas we seem to have gone to Haiti and said, we want to replicate that system. You know, we, like now, you know, we have a low trust society. Like in Singapore, because I performed in Singapore quite a few times. I was outside this comedy club talking to the promoter, and it's on this busy street, mopeds zooming up and down, you know, people, gangs of people out drinking and stuff, and somebody left their, you know, their iPhone and their bag, handbag on a table, and went inside, and I was like, whoa, you left your stuff on the table, and the promoter's like, whoa, she's keeping the place. It's like, yeah, but somebody's going to zoom down on a moped and nick it in London, that'd be gone in like 10 seconds, and yet they've just got this high trust society, possibly linked to the fact that you could die if you break the law, but in Scotland, part of the drug problem in Scotland is so insane that it's like 3.5 or 4 times higher than the rest of the UK. It's the highest, I believe the highest in Europe by a considerable margin. We're having like over 1,000 drug deaths a year, I believe. And also there's a lot of, you know, under the radar, under the sort of headline overdoses, there's a lot of, you know, ill health and social ills caused by drug abuse. And the SNP don't seem to want to fix it. They do things like the minimum unit alcohol pricing, which means that it actually makes it more expensive to get drunk on cider or whatever. So instead, it makes street drugs comparatively cheaper. And I think underlying the whole drug problem in Scotland is just that there's an absolute poverty of aspiration in Scotland. I'm friends with a few like sort of businessmen in Scotland. One of them was saying the entire economic growth over the last, you know, 15 years in Scotland has come from the public sector. There just isn't. If anything, they're clamping down and they're socialising, you know, more and more of the private sector. It's becoming harder and harder to make a living there. And he's actually leaving Scotland because his personal income tax is going to go up to just insane levels,
and then it hollows out even more because more people do that, and so you have to double down on the socialization.
I think it's this. Scotland's a kind of hopeless place, and you can trust me, I grew up there. You know what I mean, when I say, like, even if people do have are aspirational, there's a real sort of tall poppy syndrome as well. Who did you think he is? Why is he not just going on the dole? Why is he it's too good for the doll? He's getting a job. You know what I mean? That kind of.
You grew up in Glasgow.
Yeah. That kind of. No, I grew up in southwest, out in the countryside, and you know, man, there's so much like creativity and inventiveness and genuinely smart people in Scotland. But like, man, I feel like this generation is coming through. They're all like fat. They got blue hair. They just want gibs from the government. They're like, oh, give me that. People don't understand when the government gives you something. They're not like that's like P.G. O'Rourke said. It's like the cattle in the barn getting hay. It's not, you know, it's not this largesse from the government. Number one, it's like money was taken off somebody, and now, you know, that's through some wasteful procurement process. They're buying some shit to give to you, and like it's when the government funds something, it's not charity, or they're controlling. It means they control something. And, you know, now that the Arts Council, or whatever it's called in Scotland, the Arts Council is called something else, Creative Scotland or something, now that it's responsible for comedy as well, man, it's just coming in and, like, making... I got one of their forms to fill in, because I see all these, like, dog shit open mic comedians getting, like, 15 grand from the government to put on, like, some play about how, you know, racism is bad or whatever. And it's like... Man, because obviously, man, that's going to change people's minds. There's a lot of racists out there who are going to spend 15 quid on a ticket to go and watch a play about how racism is bad. You're really changing people's minds there. Yeah. It's not like everybody going to that play is going to already think that racism is bad. But anyway, I got one of these forms, and the whole thing was all like, you know, do you have any queer, non-binary, blah, 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 what, you know, all the race and the colour and stuff? It's like, what about the ideas? You know what I mean? Why has everything got to be funneled down into just being about these things? And obviously, once the government controls the venues, controls the funding streams, I mean, in Scotland, insanely, the government owns the main comedy clubs, the Stand comedy clubs. They're owned by Tommy Shepherd. So, you know, good luck criticizing the SNP on stage at
the
stand.
Quite, yeah, but this is the thing, like the whole spirit of DEI and like whatever you want to call it, diversity, equity and inclusion, is fundamentally anti-human excellence. It's all about trying to, like, in the name of equality, the relentless pursuit of equality, being willing, like, obviously they will lie and say you can have equality and excellence, but of course what they basically mean there is that it's what Russell Kirk called the leveling impulse that so much of the left have. If we can just raise everything to the ground to the same sort of mediocre standards, then at least there's parity.
And then kill everybody who tries to rise above it.
Exactly.
Literally kill people who try to rise above it in a plane that's been put together by, you know, diversity.
The wheels quite literally fall off.
And so, like, whether you're talking about surgery or whether you're talking about jet aircraft or we're talking about comedy, like, it cannot help but go after sort of those kind of rare bursts of human excellence.
Sure. Well, I mean, even talking about planes or spaceships, you know, like Elon Musk said, like, it wouldn't even matter if a company was, you know, in favor of like having diversity, equity, inclusion and meritocracy. Because the second that you have to compete with meritocracy in any other way, you devalue it. It should be the only proper standard.
Oh yeah, no, you can't. Yeah, like if merit isn't coming first as a criteria, if diversity and inclusion is coming first as your criteria, then merit can at best be a close second, and it's going to be.
And
trapped.
That's not good enough.
And it won't be good enough. Yeah, and plus also,
this Boeing is now apparently finding
the other thing and the other thing they do is they. When they realize they're on the defensive, what they do is they try to deconstruct the meaning of these terms. So they will argue that meritocracy is an inherently white concept, for example. they'll say no. And they'll do the same thing with science. They'll do the same thing with engineering. If there's not perfect parity being naturally and organically achieved between different groups, they will assume that the game was rigged in some way, and they will reanalyze the terms of our. They will sort of deconstruct our measuring instruments.
Yeah.
Not just the outcomes themselves, but the measuring instruments we use to.
Well, I mean, that's another great example of the woke being more correct than the mainstream, because meritocracy is basically a European construct.
But there's no reason why it can't be.
I think it's just the natural world. Mm. It's been, you know, if you're the best lion, you're going to eat the best antelopes.
Yes, but in human societies,
shag all the lionesses.
That as well. But in human societies, of course. Meritocracy didn't, like, in a certain sense, like, you're right, like, all of life takes place on a Darwinian plane, and so, you know, you can't be mediocre forever, because otherwise you're going to be, you know, edited out of the gene pool. But in human societies, of course, like, prior to the rise of meritocracy in the late 18th and early 19th centuries, there was a there were other, I suppose, biases that got in the way of that, such as the attachment to church, the attachment to the aristocracy, and that sort of thing.
Kings weren't ruling because they were decided to be the best person to rule.
Not always. Yeah. I mean, some of those were pretty good kings, but not always, indeed. And so, but today, like, anyway, like, you're right. What they do is, it just goes to show that their belief in social constructionism gets them out of everything.
Because if
you think that everything is a sort of social construct, then when what you expected to happen doesn't happen, you can go back and reanalyze your measuring techniques. You can reanalyze your concepts. And so, it turns out that we thought that the civil rights movement had done everything that we needed it to do, because we won equality on paper, into equality before the law on paper. It's written into legislation. Therefore, that's done. But then if you're not seeing black people entering mathematics courses at the same rate as Asians, or at the same rate as Jews, or at the same rate as whites, clearly what we need to do is not reassess our understanding of human nature.
There's a structural bias against black people becoming getting onto the maths team at the maths Olympiad.
And they will even say that maths, you get this openly now, maths is a white supremacist construct. Like, we need to deconstruct what mathematical truth means.
But why aren't they also sort of, I mean, I think it would help their case if they applied that to, I don't know, Premier League football as well, or basketball, and said, you know, why don't we have enough disabled Vietnamese 80-year-olds playing professional basketball?
Where are all the 5'6" in Ashkenazi Jews as well? They're completely schizophrenic on this, but their social constructionism means they will always find a way out of it.
And also they'll reinterpret things, I mean, and just present it as if there's no other option. And I think, you know, the thing you got to remember is so many people are just thick as fuck, and the sort of left.
I can't forget that.
The left are the worst, because, like, they don't know that they're thick as fuck. At least people on the right kind of know that they're thick, you know. But like, Guardian readers all think that they're fucking I got a professor in I've got a PhD in like history of tampons or whatever. And it's like, man, just this week I was reading the Guardian had a thing that, like, Muslims are targeted by prison guards in prisons with pepper spray because they're more likely to be pepper sprayed. And it's like, well, that, you know, one interpretation of that is that prison guards are just like walking around being like, well, you're Muslim, you know what I mean? The other thing is that, wow, we've got a lot of Islamic extremists in prison who are then radicalizing other Muslims and then, you know, sort of organizing and attacking prison guards, which is what prison guards have been complaining about. But The Guardian can't even, like, you know, for them, the data says this is a fact. Mm-hmm. Muslims are being targeted. Mm-hmm. Whereas, I mean, I used to be a criminal intelligence analyst and, like, you don't sort of apply, you know, that... You don't apply the sort of result like that before, like, really picking apart the situation. There could be a lot of reasons these people are getting targeted.
Well, so not just attacking guards, but I mean, as I understand it, our prisons are pretty balkanized across tribal lines, and whereas in the United States most of that tribalism tends to be expressed in racial terms.
Yeah.
So sort of you have the white gang, you have the Hispanic gang, you have the black gang, all that sort of thing. In Britain it tends to break down along sectarian lines because of some of the cultural enrichment we've had over the last 20 years. It means that our prisons are much more balkanized along these lines. And so I would imagine there are lots of instances where you get the Muslim gang getting into a bit of a fight with the Hindu gang or whatever it might be, Sikh gang, whatever, or indeed maybe just a white gang, and then, you know, obviously the police need to get involved.
The Buddhist gang, and Ashkenazi Jew gang,
and the Quaker gang.
I mean, the worst thing is, if you're a Hindu, like, there's probably not many Hindus in prison with you, so, like, you're gonna be on your own. You're gonna be a target.
Yeah, it's true. So yeah, the other thing I was going to bring up is that quite amusingly, back to Scotland, wasn't it the case that the poster girl for this new hate speech law, I forget what her name was,
Lindsay. What was it? I can't remember.
Well, the viewers look it up. Just type in the poster girl of the new SNP hate speech law, and it turned out that she was herself
member of MEND,
like a committed Islamist.
Yeah, yeah.
And what is MEND? So I don't actually know that.
MEND,
some sort of Muslim organization. I don't know the full details, but they're accused of spreading extremist Islamist propaganda and also boosting Islam anti-Semitic.
It's very hard to imagine why a person like that would want to be a government spokesperson.
This is very confusing. Like so then they're an explicitly non-violent group, but they nevertheless insist on seeing all political issues through a sort of relentlessly divisive, zealous Islamic lens, and so, which I suppose would qualify as a pretty good definition
non-violent
for
jihadis.
Not jihadis. They wouldn't call themselves jihadis, but yes, basically similar to the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt, in that they officially renounce violence. I don't want to accuse men of being incipiently violent, because that might not be true. But what I'm saying is that like they make no bones about their Islamic identity, and they make no bones about the fact that all politics, as far as they're concerned, is going to take place on the plane of their Islamic identity. And of course, that's an incredibly divisive thing to be doing.
I got to say, man, British nationalists or white nationalists or whatever, they must be looking at Islamists and being like, who does their PR? Like, we can't get away. We can't even print out a sticker saying it's okay to be white. And these guys are running about calling for jihad, and the Met Police are making excuses for them. And, like, you know, the government are funding. Government are funding the Green Lane Mosque in Birmingham, which was literally hosting hate preachers saying what the best way to stone a woman to death is, and, you know, why homosexuals should be killed. They're getting government money. Man, like, do you think the government would ever consider funding some sort of far right fascist rally for white people? It's insane. I can't believe people look at this stuff and they're like, yeah, no, this is fair. This has all been applied fairly. We're treating all
kinds
fairly.
I think it's really like a sign of the absurdity of the times that, like, if you go to the government, you really say, just don't give money to people that want to overthrow you. That's considered like a far right screed. like just don't try to fund your enemy. Your explicit enemy that is saying they hate you.
And if you don't mind, stop importing them as well. So this is the peculiar, like, it's so, we've been speaking about it quite a bit in the last few weeks on this program. This strange kind of even-handedness where obviously Sunak made his speech where he kind of put the threat of the far right not defined at all. And I only ever see the words far right. In fact, there was a Lord who was asked in the House of Lords the other day to try and define far right. Ironically, his name was Lord Sharp. And he said, far right is any kind of ideology which pushes far right causes, far right values and far right ideas,
like the most circular possible, like racist systems.
Yeah, exactly. Like, yeah, yeah. No, it was pretty demented.
They did have the hate crime. Like, the definition of hate in any hate crime bill is a circular definition.
Stirring up hate.
Well. Yeah. Same with the definition of, like, what is a woman in any, you know, gender ideology legislation. They're like, a woman is anyone who believes they're a woman. Mm. I said, well, what's a woman?
Yeah, well, it's the, like, it's, you know, people with bad motivations are always going to take advantage of ambiguity, which is why the left love it.
The definition of a hate crime is always a crime committed by somebody I hate.
Yeah, exactly. That's basically, that is the official definition. I mean, that is one which actually makes
sense. I hate. No, I know. I get it.
I know. Yeah. I see what you mean. Right, yeah. But in any case, well, I suppose the point being that even though this woman likely falls afoul of much of the many of the definitions which are enshrined in this new hate speech law herself, people who notice her presence here and perhaps resent her presence here are probably much more likely to be arrested under this new law. Yeah. Like, I mean, you must be struck by the double standards here. And I suppose the question is, we know, I mean, what do we think? In a country like Britain, which is, you know, supposedly devoted to the rule of law and equality before the law, how have we plunged into this scenario where there seems to be a strange kind of anarcho-tyranny, where certain people are treated with the utmost seriousness and other people are just allowed to behave in the most monstrous fashion and to say the most monstrous things, and the authorities won't pick up on that in the same way?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. Also, there's been a sort of a lot of societal hypnosis to say that anybody who does notice these discrepancies or anybody who does complain about, you know, bad behavior from certain groups is a racist or is far right. Like the grooming gangs is a classic example. Man, that's horrific crimes. Like, it's the scandal of modern Britain. It's horrific, and the crimes were committed. I mean, if we're going to talk about hate, if we're going to talk about racism, these are crimes motivated by racism. They're targeting, you know, young white and Sikh girls because they're seen as, you know, infidels. They're not part of the gang, and literally the gang. And, you know, man, just the worst crimes. I mean, Britain is such a classist country that these things can happen to white working class girls, and there isn't the sort of mass outcry. And now the left has sort of successfully hypnotized everybody to believe that anybody even mentions grooming gangs is some sort of, you know, far right bigot, or is just against Islam for some reason. Yeah. Just randomly hates Islam for some reason.
The grooming gangs, I know I've brought this up on the show before, but the grooming gangs thing is especially bad because when I tell people in, like, America or Canada, where I'm from, about the grooming gangs thing, they literally think that I've, like, lost my mind. And they're like, you're spending way too much time on the internet. That's, like, a far-right conspiracy theory. Yeah, and I'm like, no. This is, like, government fact. This is, like, undeniably true. They can't believe it. Mm. So, like, people inside of Britain don't want to talk about it, and nobody outside of Britain can believe it happened because it's so fucking bad.
Mm. Yeah. It's almost something so awful that people can't look at it, can't conceptualize it and take it for what it is. And the left has done a pretty good job of sort of just even trying to hide the fact, you know, spread some smoke over the whole issue. Ella Cockbean, who's a researcher at the Jill Dando Institute of Crime Sciences at UCL, who I worked with when I was a criminal intelligence analyst. I worked alongside them. They used to be a credible organization. She wrote a piece in The Guardian about how actually it's not Muslim Pakistani men. It's, you know, it's mostly they're not overrepresented in this type of crime, and it's mostly white men or whatever. And it's like, you know, she's sort of willfully misinterpreting real data. And also, I want to know what data she's looking at, because, like, the one thing that you can't hide is the mugshots. Mm. Like, when you look at the mugshots, I'm like, so where are these?
Which part of Northumbria are these chaps from? Yeah, no, it's so true. And, like, there are so many dishonest moves that they make. It's actually staggering. Like, one of them, I remember there used to be, one of the things they used to do is that they would treat paedophilia in general rather than grooming gangs in particular. And those two deserve to be treated as separate categories of crime. It's one thing to brutalize and rape a child as an individual. It's another thing entirely to, like, be, usually if you were into that sort of thing, you'd keep quiet about it, but to be doing it with your cousins, with your friends, well, like that, and it's in those grooming gang offenses that, yeah, that those types of men that
and if you look
are
at,
overrepresented.
If you look at cultural differences, I'm pretty sure, you know, your sort of native British nonce isn't like, you know, phoning up his brothers, his cousins, his mates, being like, I've got like a 12-year-old girl, she's drunk, she's in the basement, I've raped her, do you want to come around and rape her too? Mm-hmm. Like, you know, as horrific as all nonces are, I think there's a cultural there's a cultural distaste for it. And you know, native British society,
of course there is,
you know, which is probably seen as far right extremism,
a wide construct even to notice.
This is
clearly true. I think my read on it, not particularly revolutionary, but it seems to me that what the real thing that's killing us, I talked a little bit earlier about how I think blank slatism is killing us, the idea that we're all fundamentally the same. Because that is precisely out of that you get this obsession with social constructs, and like the denial of human nature is a big part of this. But the other thing is just this sort of the almost theological obsession with minorities and minority interests and that sort of thing. And so like the reason why, even though on any kind of like egalitarian account of the law, you would expect a people shouting for jihad in the streets. Mm. To be prosecuted with twice as much vigor as someone like Sam Melia, who merely put some stickers, probably about 70% of them, which I agreed with, by the way, of his stickers, 30% of them, like they're making it all about Jews and that sort of thing. Yeah. I didn't like that, but the 70% of which I agree with is completely lawful speech. He's allowed to say that sort of thing. Yeah. And yet he's going to get 2 years in prison.
Yeah,
like, this, I mean, the only thing that's separating those two categories of offense, apart from the fact that the Muslim one is far worse, the shouting for jihad, Hizb ut-Tahrir shouting for jihad in the street is much worse, is the fact that what the Hizb ut-Tahrir can do, even though that they would be pretty intolerable and intolerant as a majority in this country, were they to become a majority, for the moment at least they can pose as a kind of cringing minority, whereas Sam Melia is supposed to represent like an incipiently dangerous, violent majority in waiting. And that's why there's this, and obviously anti-whiteness plays a huge role as well, but like that's how it's rationalized in kind of minoritarian, majoritarian language.
Yeah, there's this sort of narrative that there's this huge swarm of far right white supremacist nationalists in the UK.
Yeah, yeah.
It's like, man, where are they? I'd meet them. You'd think I'd run into them sometimes. You know what I mean?
this is the, you know, Rishi Sunak's, you know, dangerous far right is like one bald guy in the middle of nowhere putting stickers on them.
Yeah,
that's about as bad as it can get here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, I don't know. I mean, that's the Sam Melia guy. Like, I mean, this might be the American in me, like, you know, just cringe. And a lot of this stuff was like pretty kind of rough, but it's also not illegal to be a dumbass.
Yeah.
Like,
well, the only ones that I felt, just speaking for myself, I mean, people can disagree, but the only things that I found, I mean, a lot of it was just facts, like saying that we will be a minority. Like,
that's from an Oxford academic by 2066. In fact, it's probably a hopelessly optimistic deadline.
At this point, David Coleman crunched those numbers about five or six years ago, so it's likely that the trend lines have changed. So, like, that, a lot of it was just reporting facts, which, if you're celebrating them, is good.
I mean, more like little hats.
Yeah, the anti-Semitic stuff was domestic.
I'm not a big fan of that, but, like, it shouldn't be legal.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Illegal, you mean. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, like, you can do that in America.
Yeah,
of course.
I think still.
Looking at the sort of the anti-Semitism issue on the, because you see it on the left and on the right, but for the right to be saying, because they say that, oh, these people, the Jews are behind all
orchestrating
this. Orchestrating
it.
It's like, man, that doesn't make any sense. Mm. That doesn't make any sense. From the point of view of Jews, I've got Jewish friends, and they're terrified of. They're saying, and before, you know, a couple of years ago, they were like, "Man, the way Britain is going, I'm going to have to move to Israel." Mm-hmm. And now they're saying, "Man, I don't even know if I can move to Israel because, you know, support for Israel in the West is plummeting as we change our population, as we import the Muslim world, and also as we become much more sort of radical left wing as a sort of majority stance." There isn't going to be the support for Israel in the West that there's been for the last, you know, 65 years.
I was in Israel just a little while ago, and they basically all said the same thing. They said, like, we're on our own. We're totally on our own. Nobody. And I asked them about London. They're all like, you guys are fucked.
Well, if you look at the history of any country that's been colonized by Islam, particularly if it's a majority Christian country. So Lebanon, for example, I don't know why people aren't looking at the examples given by Lebanon and, you know, in the Balkans and Yemen as well, and Iran. I mean, Iran, the leftists were co-opted by the Islamists. They marched side by side.
What happened to their
leftist ideals after that? I guess they got a kind of communism.
Indeed,
they got some of the same things you get in communism. A lot of people died. But I mean, it's ridiculous that the left will, you know, support such a diametrically opposed ideology to what the left is supposed to be.
It's also incredibly cynical the way in which even when the people who I think have good cause to fear going to London on a Saturday at the moment, obviously primarily Jews, but also, like, you know, anti-whiteness plays a big part in this as well. Yeah. Like, there was one of the signs which encapsulated this best, actually, was when it said you're either on the right side of history, and it had like the third world flags on it, or the white side of history. And Britain and Israel were all there, because in many of their minds at least, sort of Jew codes kind of white, colonizer, European, that sort of thing. And so I think anti-Semitism and pervasive anti-whiteness are very closely bound up here, but the people who have genuine reason to fear going to London on Saturdays are people who fall into those demographic brackets. But people like Sadiq Khan will constantly try to say, well, clearly the real problem is the backlash, the Islamophobic backlash. And the one thing that I think just completely belies how ludicrous that is, not so that it's not possible in principle and physically for people to commit, you know, unspeakable crimes against Muslims. There was a guy who drove into a mosque in Finsbury Park. Like, that kind of thing can happen. But put it this way, how many Jews are assembling in the street to publicly pray in a kind of triumphalist fashion as Jews? No Jew in their right mind would be doing that in London at the moment. Yet Muslims do it on bridges, they do it in Parliament Square all of the time. Like, if Islam in this country really was such a cowed and petrified force because there was a kind of rampant epidemic of Islamophobia going on, why the hell are they so public and triumphalist?
You can't even pray publicly as a Christian here, depending on what you may or may not be around.
Indeed, exactly. So, but it goes to show, like, clearly Muslims aren't cowed in this country. They feel emboldened. And that was the most astonishing thing about October 7th. It was more like what happened on October 8th for me, because that was before Israel had responded. So they couldn't hide. Now they're hiding behind a kind of disinterested humanitarianism. We're just interested in the humanitarian fallout, and I think it's legitimate to care about that, actually. But clearly these people aren't driven by a disinterested humanitarianism, because they don't care about the Armenians who were ethnically cleansed in Azerbaijan 3 months ago. So, like, it's not as though their humanitarianism touches all possible global causes. They're specifically fixated on this one because it touches on their Muslim identity.
This is kind of a total aside, but it was one of the funniest things that I've seen in recent memory. Did you see the video of the Palestinian guy who's complaining about the MREs that were dropped in? He's like complaining about, like, how bad MREs taste, and he's like, this is like,
tell our audience what MREs are.
Meals, exactly. And so it's basically to keep a soldier going so that you can, like, fight and, like, you know, hike across sand dunes, right? So if you're like an activist sitting around making TikTok videos, you should be good. He's sitting around, he's like, the peanut butter is the only thing that I like in this. It's just been, like, dropped out of a plane. I'm like, oh my god, dude.
The people who were sort of not to praise them because they were in the Wehrmacht, but people who were sort of undergoing the siege of Stalingrad and were eating their friends' toes, I think would have been very their dead friends' frostbitten toes. Would have been very happy to have an MRE dropped.
I honestly thought when I was watching the video, you'll have to check it out, I was wondering if he was like, it was like satire and he was going to be like, my cousin has like a nut allergy or something like this, but he was dead serious.
It's peculiar. The other thing I suppose we could talk about before we finish, Leo, is obviously you're a popular fixture on GB News. You do the Free Speech Nation show you do?
I do headliners.
You do the headlines at the end.
I've got, which is a sort of paper review show that goes out at 11 p.m. And I've got my own show called the Saturday Night Showdown, which is fun. It goes out at 8 p.m. on a Saturday, and it's starting to, you know, pick up a bit. Headliners, I mean, my show, I just go through all the craziest things of the week, like conspiracy theories and crazy things that have happened. It's great because I can choose from all the, man, every week that we could make a show long. It's insane. And Headliners is like a paper review show, so we
that's
go through
right
the next day's newspapers, which is annoying because, like, quite often we'll be reading, so we read out the headline and we go digging at the story, so people on Twitter always assume that we're saying The headline, it's our opinion. It's like, no, we're just reading it from The Guardian so we can then discuss the story. You know what I mean?
Another Ofcom bridge.
Oh, man. What's that?
Is this another Ofcom
bridge? No, no. So
pretending
people,
it's news.
No, people, no. So it is news. It's in The Guardian or wherever it is. But we read out the headline that The Guardian have written and discuss, you know, the story in The Guardian. But people think that us reading out the headline means that this headline, it's my opinion, and I wrote it, and, you know, people just don't... Because everybody's thick. Remember at school? Did you go... I don't know what sort of school you went to. At my school, there's, like, a lot of thick... Like, people just so thick, you're like, fucking, man... Like people literally left my school, unable to read. Mm. And they're like, oh, fair enough, they don't need to know how to read. They just need to know what sacks is fertilizer and what sacks is poison. But, man, it's like, those people are out there. They don't. I was, because I'm like, man, I was like, did alright at school, but I'm still, I struggle with forms and, like, you know, it's the tedium and the admin of everyday life, you know what I mean? And it's like, man, how did people, like, all the fucking hassle just getting a bank account and stuff like that? Well, like, I'm like, so if I'm having trouble, what are these people doing? But yeah, they're out there on Twitter.
The classic George Carlin line, which is like, think of how dumb the average person is and realize half of them are dumber than that.
Indeed. Well, on that note,
that'd be the median.
Oh, there you go.
On that note of misanthropic despair, thank you so much, Leo, for coming on to Deprogram. It was a real pleasure. Yeah. Evan, thank you as ever. You've been watching Deprogrammed. Make sure to like, subscribe, leave a comment if you wish, and we shall see you on the next one.
Hello, if you're enjoying the New Culture Forum channel and you believe in our mission, may I invite you to join our membership scheme at the link below or on our website, newcultureforum.org.uk. Our work is more important now than ever, and we have great plans ahead for the future, but we can't do it without your support. From as little as £3 per month, you can help ensure that we continue on our mission. As a member, you'll receive a range of benefits, including access to exclusive content, invitations to our private events, including here at our studios, free copies of our books, and much, much more, including, of course, our famous NCF mug. If you aren't able to become a member, then please help us by clicking this button and subscribing to our channel. It's completely free. Just remember to also click the bell icon so that you can get notifications when we post new videos. Thank you.